Les colloques du Collège de France.
So without further delay, we'll now move to the second session of the first panel with two other distinguished scholars. We'll first listen to Nadia Aboulhaj, who is an anthropologist and Middle East studies scholar. Nadia Aboulhaj is Anne Whitney Olin Professor at Barnard College and co-director of the Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia University. Her publication includes Facts on the Ground, Archaeological Practice and Territorial Self-Fashioning in Israel Society in 2001, The Genealogical Science, The Search for Jewish Origins and Politics of Epistemology in 2012, and Combat Trauma, Imaginaries of the War and Citizenship in Post 9/11 America, published by Verso in 2022. Nadia's current project is a set of essays that grapple with the last 2 years of genocide and total war in Gaza. Her presentation is entitled Illiberal War on Trauma, Intent and Annihilation. You have the floor for 30 minutes, Nadia.
January 4th, 2025. The New York Times published an interview with then outgoing Secretary of State of the US, Antony Blinken. Responding to questions about Israel's military atrocities, he said, and I quote, "The very first trip I made to Israel 5 days after October 7th, I spent 9 hours in the IDF headquarters in Tel Aviv, 6 stories underground with the Israeli government, arguing for hours on end about the basic proposition that humanitarian assistance needed to get to Palestinians in Gaza. That argument took place because in Israel, I'm still quoting, you had a totally traumatized society. It wasn't just the prime minister or a given leader in Israel. This was an entire society that didn't want any assistance getting to a single Palestinian in Gaza. I argued for 9 hours," unquote. Throughout the interview, Blinken dodged the reporter's questions about Israel's war crimes. Instead, he offered repeated reassurances of the U.S. commitment to the protection of the civilian population. And I quote Blinken again, "We wanted to make sure to the best of our ability that the children, women, and men in Gaza were as protected as possible and got the assistance they needed to survive this horrific conflict," unquote. The more the reporter pushed, the more Blinken pivoted to humanitarian assistance. He did not call for Israel to end the war. He refused to concede that Israel is violating international law. He defended his own and the U.S.'s moral stature by insisting that they, quote, ensured that more assistance got to people in Gaza, unquote, although in actual fact, they ensured no such thing. Blinken could not have been a better spokesperson for the contours of Talal Assad's understanding of liberal violence. Liberal violence, that is, quote, legitimate violence exercised in and by the modern progressive state, and I'm quoting Assad, is characterized by a constitutive paradox, he writes. It combines cruelty and compassion. What matters is not that one kills, but rather, quote, how one kills and with what motives, unquote. In what he calls the liberal West's culture of war, violence against a collective enemy, which of course includes civilians, is legitimate, even as that culture also holds to the humanitarian desire to save human lives. In short, we kill, and yet we do not do so lightly. We kill, and yet we do so only when absolutely necessary. We kill, and yet we suffer guilt and shame for having done so. In this culture of war, and in contrast to our enemies, we always choose the lesser evil. In his responses to the reporter, Blinken was doing more than just insisting on US liberal virtue, however. He was also trying to recuperate the liberal virtue of the Israeli state. He offered some tempered criticism of Israel's conduct of the war. For example, with regard to, quote, the provision of humanitarian assistance, he said, we've found periods of time when we didn't think they were doing enough, unquote. Nevertheless, that was no admission of war crimes. And I quote him again, there's a big difference between intent and result. The results that we were seeing were grossly insufficient, but there is a very different question about what was the intent, unquote. A question regarding intent, Blinken had already stated baldly that in October 2023, no one, not the prime minister, not the politicians and military leaders in that bunker 6 floors underneath the ground, not the entire society, wanted any assistance getting to a single Palestinian in Gaza. What's more, he denied intent despite the fact that 15 plus months later, politicians, pundits, journalists, and citizens in Israel were still saying and doing the same things. The intent to punish Gazans, every single one of them, was and remains widely and publicly declared, and it has been realized in Israel's military strategy on the ground. October 9, 2023, quote, "We are fighting human animals and we act accordingly. We are imposing a complete siege on Gaza. There will be no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything will be closed," Yoav Gallant, then Israel's Minister of Defense, declared. And so it has been. October 10th, Israel's President Isaac Herzog avowed, quote, "It is an entire nation out there that is responsible. It is not true, this rhetoric about civilians not being aware, not involved," unquote. There are, in other words, no innocence in Gaza. So what excuses such speech acts, especially in the face of bold-faced evidence that such words have been realized on the ground? Enter trauma, I want to suggest. To return to Blinken's words, he spent 9 hours arguing in favor of providing humanitarian assistance to Palestinians because, quote, "you had in Israel a totally traumatized society," unquote. In my talk, I explore the workings of this trauma imaginary, or the trauma imaginary that Blinken invokes. Who is traumatized by what, or whom or what? Placing the trauma of October 7th within the iterative structure of Auschwitz, I explore the ways in which the presumption of traumatic repetition displaces the ubiquitous self-evidence of Israeli genocidal intention, and most decidedly for Euro-American political, cultural, and economic elites. I begin with the traumatized Israeli soldier. October 2024, CNN aired a story titled, "He Got Out of Gaza, But Gaza Did Not Get Out of Him." A 40-year-old reservist and father of four, I quote, "returned from Gaza a different person," unquote. Struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, he committed suicide before he was scheduled to return to the fight. CNN tells us that Israeli soldiers' accounts, quote, "offer a rare glimpse into the brutality of what critics have called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's forever war and the intangible toll it takes on soldiers who participate," unquote. But lest it be misunderstood, this mention of brutality implies no critique. Instead, CNN continues, "even as it takes an immense psychological toll," and I quote, "for many soldiers, the war in Gaza is a fight for Israel's survival and must be won by any means," unquote. CNN's war story is most directly an account of the struggles and suicide of one soldier. Upon his return from Gaza, this military bulldozer operator suffered bouts of anger, sweating, insomnia, and social withdrawal. As recounted by a fellow member of his military unit, quote, "soldiers had to run over terrorists dead and alive in the hundreds." This fellow soldier described the horror. "Everything squirts out," he continued. "It's hard to eat, especially meat." According to Mizrahi's mother, he, quote, Mizrahi was the soldier who committed suicide, "he saw things that were never seen in Israel." She says, "he saw a lot of people die. Maybe he even killed someone. We don't teach our children to do things like this, so maybe it was a shock to him." Of course, given universal military conscription, with the exception of the Orthodox Jews, and decades upon decades of occupation and wars, it's hard to understand how anybody can say, "we do not teach our children to do things like this." But Mizrahi's story is not the only trauma story that CNN recounts. And I quote again, "for the tens of thousands of Israelis who volunteered or were called up to fight, the war in Gaza was seen as an existential battle," unquote. In this war, as they continue, Hamas are, quote unquote, "the new Nazis," Netanyahu has declared. They also quote Joe Biden, "the ancient hatred of Jews endorsed by the Nazis was brought back to life on October 7th. In short, as framed by such words, Israel, among the most militarily powerful states on earth, always exists on the brink of annihilation, or so it is imagined and proclaimed. That allegedly existential threat is woven seamlessly into CNN's report on soldiers suffering combat trauma. In so doing, CNN references another, a prior trauma imaginary. This is the originary, the foundational trauma that Blinken's comments index, and he presumes his audience will know and hear. Yes, October 7th was traumatic. Nevertheless, it isn't primarily the trauma of Israelis who survived the Hamas attacks to which he refers. It is not primarily the trauma of relatives or friends who lost loved ones or whose loved ones were kidnapped. Not really. This is the trauma, the traumatic repetition of a long history of anti-Semitic violence that culminates in the Nazi genocide, into which October 7th was seamlessly absorbed. Hamas are the new Nazis. They have brought back to life the ancient hatred of Jews. This is the trauma of what I call the triad of Auschwitz genocide evil that in many ways Daryl elaborated and that I'm not going to elaborate today. That is a trauma now built into the very heart of the post-war order of truth in which Auschwitz has never been just a new form of evil, but an unprecedented one and a measure of all else. That is the referent we are all presumed to recognize and empathize with. That is the trauma out of which the Israeli state was born, and that trauma grounds an alternative account of intent. Put another way, the trauma of Auschwitz genocide evil furnishes a different kind of intention, a motive that exists at the level of affect rather than reason. And that motive whitewashes genocidal intent. Reading speech acts. December 2023, South Africa filed a case charging Israel with violating the Genocide Convention. Laying out its case before the ICJ that January, or January 24, South Africa's legal team enumerated violations of international law. The sheer volume of bombs dropped on the Strip, at a, quote, unparalleled and unprecedented civilian casualty count, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, homes, medical facilities, universities. They documented what they referred to as the deprivation of basic needs and alleged that Israel's military is targeting children. And I quote one of the lawyers, "This is nothing short of the destruction of Palestinian life, and it is inflicted deliberately," unquote. A second lawyer highlighted an extraordinary feature of this genocide, and I quote, "The reiteration and repetition of genocidal speech throughout every sphere of state in Israel," unquote. The legal team then provided endless examples. I'll just list a few. October 9th, 2023, the Minister of Defense, Gallant, told troops at the Gaza border that he has, quote, "released all constraints. Gaza won't return to what it was before. We will eliminate everything." October 28th, in an address to Israeli forces, Prime Minister Netanyahu, quote, "urged the soldiers to remember what Amalek has done to you," referencing the biblical command to Saul that Didier referred to destroy an entire group of people known as the Amalekites as revenge. What's more, the South Africa case held, soldiers on the ground have understood such speech acts as they were intended. December 7th, and I quote the lawyers, "Israeli soldiers were recorded by journalists dancing and singing," and they're quoting the soldiers now, "we know our motto, there are no uninvolved. They sing that they obey one commandment," and again they're quoting the soldiers, "to wipe off the seed of Amalek." In its response before the ICJ, Israel's legal team began by noting the origins of the Genocide Convention. Israel is, they said, singularly aware of why the Genocide Convention was established. They continued to explain Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew who, quote, "witnessed the unspeakable horrors of the Holocaust," unquote, coined the term. The Israeli team then segued to October 7th. Quote, "the largest calculated mass murder of Jews in a single day since the Holocaust," and they insisted, and I quote again, "if there have been acts that may be characterized as genocidal, then they have been perpetrated against Israel," unquote. Having thus declared rightful ownership over the concept of genocide, the Israeli case rested on the claim that what has unfolded since is not genocide, but armed conflict. And it is an armed conflict during which the Israeli military, they insisted, has imbibed by international humanitarian law. So how then did the Israeli team account for the plethora of speech acts cited by South Africa? South Africa, I quote, "misunderstands the nature and provenance of certain comments made by some Israeli politicians," unquote. And they offered an alternative explanation. Some of the comments are clearly rhetorical. They were made at the height of emotion. Quote, in the immediate aftermath of an event which severely traumatized Israel, they were, quote, words expressing anguish, and as such, they cannot be seen as demanding genocide, unquote. In the words of the historian Amos Goldberg, the Israeli state held that, quote, the statements did not constitute declarations of intent as required by the convention, but were merely natural expressions of rage following the massacre on October 7th, unquote. Natural expressions of rage. Rather than natural, I want to suggest this rage is better named traumatic rage, one born of alleged historical repetition, the ongoing repetitive desire to destroy Jews. Traumatic repetition in its various iterations, anguish, shock, pain, and yes, rage, displaces genocidal intent, not just legally, but from within this discourse, perhaps even more powerfully ethically. It provides another kind of explanation. Trauma does the work of shifting the conversation from that which is manifest, the intention to kill everything that moves and to render Gaza uninhabitable, evident in both words and deeds, to motives not easily discernible on the surface. Let me return to Talal Asad here. In trying to discern why Islamic terrorists do what they do, he argues, terrorism experts engage in hermeneutics of suspicion. They dismiss manifest intentions and search instead for the secret, the real motives, not evident in their words and deeds. In the case of post-October 7th Israel, the interpretive logic is inverted, I want to say. This is a hermeneutics of exoneration, of absolution. Israeli motives, as distinct from their manifest intentions, redefine absolute rage and slaughter as an understandable, natural, expected response, that is, to such deep and enduring collective trauma. And, as is widely presumed, to refer to the traumatized subject is to refer to the victim. In an essay on mourning and statehood, the historian Gabriel Winant responds to the accusation that the Euro-American left refuses to mourn the lives of those lost on October 7th. Published already on October 13th, 2023, he writes, quote, it's not possible to publicly grieve Israeli Jewish life lost to violence without tithing ideologically to the IDF, whether you like it or not. The Zionist dream, he continues, quote, became real in the ashes of the Shoah under the sign of never again. And given that origin story, one way to understand Israel is as a machine for the conversion of grief into power. This, and I quote again, already political grief is at the core of the Zionist adventure. And so, he continues, the state will do, quote, what it does with Jewish grief, transmute it into violence, unquote. It is, of course, possible to express grief and resist its transmutation into violence. Nevertheless, immediately upon the Hamas attack, Israeli grief was transformed into devastating state violence. There is a much longer genealogy to the sign of never again, under which the Israeli state mobilizes grief and transforms it into power, than can be told in Winant's brief, albeit powerful intervention. Never again did not emerge immediately after the Second World War, even though from the late pre-state period through the 1948 war and the 1956 Suez crisis, Arab leaders were repeatedly referred to as Nazis. Nevertheless, the mobilization of grief for political purposes would take more time to emerge. In its focus on victims, the Eichmann trial was a crucial turning point. In putting survivors on the witness stand, the annihilation of European Jewry emerged through a very different lens. For the first time, attention was paid to ordinary survivors, now rebuilding their lives. The Eichmann trial was designed, in Ben-Gurion's words, as a history lesson for the world, and it gave survivors an official stage on which to narrate their experiences of death and horror, of immense suffering and pain. In contrast to Nuremberg, and in contrast to the previous trials in Israel of alleged Jewish collaborators, the spotlight, to quote Annette Viviorka, was exclusively on the victims. In turn, victim testimony was harnessed for political ends, and here I quote Edith Zertal. The survivor would henceforth be, quote, remembered as a metaphor, a terrible, sublime lesson to Israeli youth and the world, that Jewish blood would never be abandoned or defenseless again. The late 20th century Holocaust imaginary, first birthed on that Jerusalem stage, morphed over the next few decades into far more than the history lesson Ben-Gurion imagined. Survivor stories became the ground on which a powerful affective infrastructure was built, and there I borrow Joe Masco, an anthropologist at the University of Chicago's term. By the latter decades of the 20th century, a trauma imaginary became attached to the Auschwitz genocide evil triad, and it would be wielded to expiate the horrors that the state of Israel has long and continues in ever more ghastly forms to inflict. In other words, the silencing power of Auschwitz genocide evil is not just because the triad marks an allegedly unprecedented and incomparable event. Its power is also sustained by the specter of the threat of repetition, of trauma. The evil that is Auschwitz indexes an iconic trauma that renders a pervasive anxiety and fear of repetition an affective fact more powerful than any actual empirical risk. The 1967 war was pivotal in generating Auschwitz as affective infrastructure in Israeli society and beyond. In the build-up to the war, and despite predictions by U.S. intelligence of a rapid Israeli military victory, the mood in Israel and among Jewish communities in the diaspora was of an impending apocalypse. In the aftermath of Israel's lightning victory, its then Foreign Minister Abba Eban told the UN General Assembly, quote, "No individual who lived in Israel can ever forget the atmosphere of devastation which hovered over our stressed and pressured country, surrounded and besieged, bombarded day and night with prophecies of approaching end," unquote. Fear spread far and wide among the Jewish diaspora. In the words of one prominent French intellectual quoted by Viviorca, quote, "We all felt that the threat weighing on Israel was not a political threat, but an ontological one," unquote. Or as Peter Novick has written with respect to American Jews, and I quote again, "The Holocaust was suddenly transformed from a mere, albeit tragic, history to an imminent and terrifying prospect," unquote. In short, the impending war, to return to Viviorca, was lived in genocidal mode, and it was lived in genocidal mode among Israeli and diaspora Jews alike. The Eichmann trial's history lesson, in other words, was reiterated in affective form. Over the next few decades, the Holocaust would be known increasingly in that register, that is, as an affective one, grief, fear, panic, and yes, rage, the trauma of Auschwitz. In 1956, Germany passed a new compensation law for Jewish survivors of the Nazi persecution. They could now receive reparation on the basis of disability claims, but proving disability was no easy task, and especially with respect to psychological distress. Psychiatrists submitted documentation of psychiatric disability to German courts, only to have thousands of petitions denied. Debates raged. What's the relevance of the real world to clinical practice? Is there such a thing as adult onset trauma, of delayed onset trauma? Clinicians, and here I quote Dagmar Herzog, grappled with the purported comparability between death camp experiences and other experiences of violence, unquote, say, being a victim of aerial warfare or a prisoner of war. One consequence, Herzog argues, was that, quote, an argument about the uniqueness of what we now call the Holocaust began to take shape, unquote. It would take well into the 1970s before both the Holocaust's uniqueness and its attendant theorization of trauma born of real-world violence became a kind of cultural common sense. And of course, Didier has written extensively about this, in the West, of course. Over time, post-war Holocaust consciousness and culture that began to take form following the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem incorporated the self-evidence, what was now considered self-evidence, of Jewish collective trauma, with all of its assumptions about repetition, flashbacks, the failure of language, and the atemporality that trauma theory carries in tow. Quote, "The imperative to tell the story of the Holocaust," Dory Loeb wrote in 1995, and continuing the quote, "is inhabited by the impossibility of telling. Nevertheless, tell the story survivors must. The Fortunoff Video Archive was established at Yale in 1979 so as to enable survivors to witness, as had fellow survivors during the Eichmann trial. But nearly two decades after the trial, and far away from a courtroom, witnessing had a different function. There is in each survivor an imperative need to tell and thus come to know one's story." I'm sorry, I'm quoting Dory Loeb again. "One has to know one's buried truth in order to be able to live one's life," unquote. The Fortunat Archive was but one of many audiovisual Holocaust archiving projects launched in the latter decades of the 20th century. And in contrast to the Eichmann trial, which displayed no consideration or recognition for the psychic pain of the survivors testifying on the stand, these archives collected far more than history lessons built up from individual testimonies. They recorded and preserved traumatic memories. The interviewers, for example, for the Fortunoff archive were most often supervised by a psychoanalyst. The latter decades of the 20th century saw the institutionalization of Holocaust memory in ways that went far beyond archiving projects, and again, Daryl has laid out some of this here. In 1977, the U.S. created a commission to establish a national memorial to the Holocaust, which becomes the museum he discussed. 1 year later, in 1978, The Holocaust, a television miniseries starring Meryl Streep, aired on NBC. It was watched by 120 million people in the U.S. Subsequently aired in Germany, as recounted by Annette Viviorka, it sparked a renewed German engagement with its Nazi past. More broadly, museums, memorials, school curricula, all sorts of institutions and pedagogical tools were developed throughout the West to establish Holocaust consciousness among Euro-American publics. And with the UN's 2005 designation of January 27th as International Holocaust Remembrance Day, institutionalizing Holocaust memory was to become, or at least as its effects were imagined, a global project of moral reckoning. For its part, the fall of the Soviet Union was also pivotal. It became possible to visit the sites where the Jews were annihilated, and more visits, primarily for Israeli and diasporic Jewish youth, were arranged. The March of the Living, for example, has brought thousands of teenagers year after year to see Poland's death camps, and it does so in a very specific schedule. Teenagers commemorate Yom HaShoah, the day Israel marks the Holocaust, at the death camps, and then are flown to Israel, where they celebrate Independence Day the next day. Whether as participants in Marches of the Living or on other organized trips, visitors are, Viviorka tells us, accompanied by a former camp inmate. And in her words, the reality of the former campmate's experience, unquote, is essential to the truth that they are taught, and that truth is, I want to argue, at its core, an affective one. I give you just a few examples. On one such trip, a rabbi told the teenagers he led, quote, the camps could become operational within a few hours. To take one more example, after touring Poland's death camps, an American girl declared, quote, I'm so scared, I can't go on, I want to be in Israel already, unquote. To adapt Elie Wiesel's words, if, quote, Auschwitz is a new Sinai, the place of a new covenant, in psychoanalytic terms, the Holocaust had become Israel's primal scene. But it is not in psychoanalytic terms that this new covenant is understood. This primal scene is of this world, now and forever. It is reproduced in endless repetition as if the fear, the panic, the rage is in response to an actual imminent threat. There is always the risk of another Auschwitz in this primal scene. Jews should be scared. That primal scene was repeated on October 7th, or so we are told. That traumatic repetition is the referent in talk of Israeli and Jewish panic and fear and trauma in response to Hamas attack. Israel's wars of aggression, and most centrally, the Gaza genocide, morph into wars of self-defense, even preemptive self-defense. As was true in 1967, the fact that Israel is at no actual risk of annihilation is of no concern whatsoever. Auschwitz genocide evil. As trauma, it haunts the possibility of empirical contestation or political reframing. It thwarts any meaningful moral or material reckoning with the devastating violence the Israeli state has unleashed. And let us be clear that the Israeli state continues to unleash to this day in its most brutal but hardly exclusive form in Gaza. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.